From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on October 8th, 1991, in Brooklyn. It was the site of an anti-racism march. Tensions had boiled, and organizers put together a demonstration to call out racism in New York, to call for change. The march, in some ways, did not go smoothly. Images captured by photojournalists tell a devastating story of young white men mocking the protest with watermelons, and that had become a theme. There's a photo taken earlier that year in a largely Italian-American neighborhood of white men pointing at a watermelon and laughing. Another image shows the aftermath of the march through Bensonhurst, with broken watermelons littering the streets. Residents had hurled them at marchers. The photographs tell the ongoing story of racial strife and the demonstrations that sought to make change, but they are only one chapter in a larger story of social movements. Other demonstrations focused on police brutality, AIDS, queer activism, war, the environment, reproductive rights. It all sounds fresh and relevant for 2018. In this case, though, we're talking about New York City between 1980 and 2000. Photojournalists, documentary photographers documented these moments, and an exhibit brings together some of the most powerful of those images. It's called Whose Streets, Our Streets. A gallery show opens tonight at RIT's Harris Gallery, and there's a panel discussion with some of the documentary photographers this afternoon. We'll tell you about that in a moment. This hour, our conversation focuses on the power of photojournalism to document social change and help shape public understanding. And we're also going to be talking about what has changed and what has not. My guests this hour include Josh Meltzer, a photojournalist and assistant professor at RIT. Josh, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Also with us is Meg Handler, who is a documentary photographer and also an alumna of RIT. Nice to have you here, Meg. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
And also with us is Joseph Rodriguez, who is a documentary photographer and a professor at NYU. Joseph, nice to have you as
Thank
well.
Thank you.
I'm going to start with Josh because, Josh, you reached out to me a few weeks ago and put together what I will just sort of frankly say is a series of really powerful images that if you didn't know the context of the time, in many ways you could believe that most of these images are recent. So kind of take me through a little bit of how this all came to us here at RIT, and we'll kind of work our way through some of these themes here.
Yeah, so I was brought in a little bit after the sort of birth of this project, which was through work between Meg Handler and my colleague in history, Tamar Carroll at RIT. Meg was contacted by Tamar to look into getting some pictures about the protest movements of that time. And Meg was so well connected with the photographers in New York through her work as an editor at the Village Voice, which, you know, sadly just closed just a couple weeks ago. And they, you know, started getting together and thinking about all the photographers that they knew, some of the social issues. And from this book, which was a history book, there was this idea to do something larger with it. And so Meg put together this fantastic show at the Bronx Documentary Center in January of 2017 with over 700 guests in a very small gallery. And that was, you know, sort of the birth that we needed to do more with this. And Tamar and I talked with Meg, and we decided that we could bring it to RIT. We could show more images. I developed a website, and I've produced a little short film. But this was something that, you know, came as a collaborative effort through Meg and Tamar over the last several years.
Listeners, follow along if you can. The website, Josh?
The website is called whosestreets.photo.
Whosestreets.photo. We'll link you to that on our various platforms, but it's easy to find, beautifully put together, and sort of segmented by all these different issues that drew their own social protests and demonstrations throughout those couple of decades in New York City. And also this afternoon, so you've got 3:30, you've got a panel discussion. What's going on?
Yes, so at 3:30 in the Carlson Auditorium at RIT, we'll have a panel with Meg, Joseph, Donna Binder, and historian Victoria Walcott, who is actually pictured in one of the images. And that'll be at 3:30, and the opening is at 5 p.m. in the William Harris Gallery.
And where is the William Harris Gallery?
It's in the Gannett Building, Building 7B on campus. It's okay. Open to the public.
You'll be able to see that gallery through when, Josh?
The gallery will be up through November 9th.
Meg, in so many ways, these photos still feel fresh to me. And I wonder how you feel having put together and worked with so many outstanding photojournalists on this. So what struck you as you started kind of putting this project together?
Well, I think one of the most important things was that in putting it together, we, myself and I think my peers, and as well as Josh and Tamar, realized that the intention of making these pictures way back when was to make them for history. But that was a very innocuous thing then. You just knew you wanted to be there. You wanted to document. We had all been inspired by previous generations of civil rights photographers, photographers who looked at social justice issues. And that's what we learned from. So I think that as documentarians and journalists, that was, you know, part of our professional goals was to, you know, document these movements for history. So when it came to starting to have a conversation about putting the show together, and when we started to think about it in pockets of different social issues and bringing together all of these names of photographers, we realized how prolific we actually all were. And I just think that it's something that doesn't become obvious to you until you go through contact sheets that you haven't looked at for 20, 30 years. Mm-hmm. And there's this kind of eureka moment of, wow, we had the right idea. And just ironically, as we were putting the show together, we were going through the campaign. And so we knew that whatever the outcome of the presidential campaign was going to be, that there was some currency to this history, that it would inspire people to either celebrate in November or start to look at things in another way. And in fact, this has now all been proven to us that these previous, you know, modes of activism have definitely inspired a new generation.
Yeah, I mean, I think this country is sort of over this whole idea that we'll be post-racial. I mean, like, how many times you heard during the Obama presidency that we were moving into a post-racial America? First of all, obviously that's not the case. And second of all, you go back to the images in this exhibit, and it wasn't that long ago. And I chose to open the hour with some of the images that hit like a hammer to me. People holding these watermelons proudly, mockingly. Just the ugliest, saddest stuff that I can really think of from this.
Well, I'd like to speak to that particular moment and picture for a second. I was very gung-ho about including that picture in the show because of the kind of dirty, iconic relevance of the watermelon. I also knew that a generation or two younger than us was not going to know what the watermelon meant. And I felt like we were giving people a little bit of an education about racist iconography and how people use objects like the watermelon to forward their ideas. And it's a really brilliant picture, and there's a lot of aggression and emotion in it. And it's the kind of picture that, you know, every picture tells a story, right? I mean, there is a story in that picture. There are 1,000 words in that moment, and it shows you the power of photojournalism and how it can teach us and how we can look at the past and try and make change.
There's such vitriolic pride that the people wielding these watermelons had that it's hard to even believe. It shouldn't be hard to believe. I'm not naive anymore. It's not hard to believe. We still would see that today in many quarters of the country. But for listeners, to Meg's point, for younger listeners who are not familiar with this usage of a watermelon, it was 1997 that a golfer of color won the Masters. Tiger Woods wins the Masters by 12 shots in 1997 at a place that's one of the most racist sporting venues in our country's history. And Fuzzy Zeller, who was a past champion, said, well, you know, it's no big deal. Next year, tell him at the champion's dinner to serve collard greens and watermelon. And, I mean, just amazing. Just amazing. That was 1997. Not that long ago. Now, of course, he did apologize. But that was used as a way to insult, to demean, to hurt. And,
right.
And the images that you've collected here are very sad. Devastating, I think, in many ways. But here we are, Meg. I mean, do you feel like maybe it's not that long ago? Maybe people wouldn't use a watermelon today, but that same sentiment is really powerful today.
Well, not only is that same sentiment really powerful, it's, I think, because of the ubiquity of social media, it is multiplied and more intense. And we talked about this earlier, about the experience of seeing these things happen in real time and then seeing the vestiges of it and how it plays itself out culturally. Charlottesville was a perfect example. I think we all knew that the country was coming to a boiling point when it came to racism, but I think that in many ways we thought we have progressed from the 60s. And that moment in Charlottesville showed us that, in fact, we haven't progressed that much. But this is a very dark moment in the culture. And we all saw it happening in real time, like we were all there, right? There's something very different about that experience versus looking at pictures that are 30 years old on the wall. There's a distance that we have from the watermelon, because that's not now. That's 1997. That's Brooklyn. It's not here. Charlottesville, I think, changed all of that.
Well, and let me ask all three of you, and I'll start with Joseph Rodriguez. So this exhibit, these images, I think bring to mind the ongoing conversation that a lot of people in the activism community, to the extent that there is a single activism community in this country, have been having for about 2 years now, which is it enough to demonstrate? Is it enough to march? Now, I think the obvious answer people have come to is no. You can't just show up one day a year and march and then go home and nothing changes. You have to work. But a lot of the people who are captured in the images in this exhibit aren't just demonstrating. They have done the work. And yet, in a lot of ways, there's not a whole lot of change. And I wonder if this exhibit then is mildly discouraging for people who wanted to see that change, or if there are lessons to draw. What do you see there, Joseph?
Well, I can reference the images that are in my images that are in the show, which are images of Spanish Harlem, East Harlem. And, you know, the folks there were desperate to get their voices heard. This was, crack was happening at the time, AIDS was happening at the time. Racism was definitely prolific in our city. Growing up as a Puerto Rican New Yorker, I felt it my whole life. All the teenage pregnancy, unemployment. Now, what was interesting about the community that I photographed was they would also go out nightly to showcase, hey, this is gentrification. These are issues that are happening. Those issues are still happening right now. Right now in the same neighborhood in our city. And so I think that the photographs that we have in the show, I think mine are from, I remember was in the 80s and still relevant today. That I find mind-boggling, really, that the people in the community are still fighting the fight. And as myself, as a documentary photographer, that's been my path for the last 40 years.
Mind-boggling, but sad?
Sad, but, you know, they're not giving up, meaning they're still out there to fight the fight. So, you know, and I just came back from Puerto Rico. It's the same there. And so, you know, and the community that I photographed in Spanish Harlem is very much connected to Puerto Rico. So there's a lineage that comes from this sort of colonialized way of doing politics with a certain group of people. So the fight still just goes on.
Hmm. Meg, what do you think?
Can you ask the question again?
I'm going to ask you not just what you think about whether this exhibit ought to induce a little sadness that change has been slow, or if there's something that you want viewers to take from that, either lessons or ideas to take from taking in these images.
I mean, I think that there's a little bit of sadness when you think, wow, I mean, we're still fighting for reproductive rights. Neighborhoods in New York are still getting gentrified. You know, I mean, you could say probably something critical about each and every one of those social issues. But I, in fact, take inspiration from this show, and I would like everybody to be inspired by this and to see the passion and enthusiasm and commitment that all of these activists and photographers possess to be out on the streets to, you know, I think that's something people don't really think about, and we can use the Kavanaugh protests as an example. You know, every day that people are in Washington taking over the Hart Building, they're not at work. They're taking a day off work, or they're taking a day away from their children, or they're making some kind of compromise to be in D.C., to make their voices heard, to put their bodies on the line. And to me, it's one of the most admirable things you can do, is to go put yourself out there to try and make change, to try and make a statement. And does it happen in one, going to one protest or two protests? No. It happens over time. It happens in multiple groups, with multiple disciplines, with multiple things to bring to the table. We're image makers. That's our contribution. You know, the person who makes the signs, who Donald Trump made fun of, works in a basement in the East Village with her own printing press, making these signs every single day and giving them to people. I personally admire that. That's hardcore activism to me. And these are the people that are in the pictures in our show.
And I think it also, you know, it speaks that the demonstration works. It matters. And sometimes it mm-hmm. doesn't matter a lot, and sometimes it matters a whole lot. You look at the power of the women who confronted Jeff Flake in the elevator as a statement of demonstration. That moment was photographed, first of all, which was very important, but it also really mattered. And the other thing that's really interesting about this group of photographers is they really are on a spectrum from activist who makes pictures to photojournalist who covers activism and everything in between. So a lot of the photographers were not only very committed to the causes that they photographed, they worked very closely with the activists. Organizations like ACT UP, I think, were very keen and savvy about aligning themselves with mm-hmm. photographers, because they understood that the power of photography was helping amplify their voices and to their success, you know, probably one of the most successful activism organizations. And a lot of the photographers photographed these issues because they lived these issues. Joseph lived these issues, and so lots of the photographers did. And that was a huge motivating factor to cover activists, because these were friends of theirs, family members. It was their neighborhoods that were on fire. It was their neighborhoods that they were being pushed out of. It was their families who were sick and that kind of thing. So those are important things to know, too. Yeah.
Okay, Justin.
Well, what I find really inspiring right now is when I look at my students, my NYU students, for example, and they're, you know, 19, 20 years old, and the concerns, for example, the shootings in Florida, and listening to those students really put themselves out there has been so inspiring for these young people. This is their time. This is what they're talking to me about in my class. This is our time, and we need to figure out a way to be able to get out there and document our time. And that, for me, is just revelatory, to be able to see that the hard work that Meg has put together, Josh and Tamar, to put this work together to show what's been done before. But now this is their time. So now there's some very serious issues on the table for, you know, like when I look at my daughters, they're 30 years old, and they're very concerned about where we're headed right now.
Now, so. I certainly don't want to leave anyone with the impression that there hasn't been change. And I think to the panel's point, change doesn't happen in a moment. It doesn't happen in a march or a day. And sometimes those are the seeds that take years, sometimes decades. But here we are, and some of these issues that we look back on in this exhibit, Whose Streets, Our Streets, New York City, 1980 to 2000, some we've seen remarkable change, and some feels like nothing has changed. You know, and you know, Joseph, you want to weigh in on that?
Well, I can talk about the East Harlem East Harlem housing groups that have worked really hard. When I was there, they were fighting to just try to take over buildings that were rat infested, drug infested, and so we talk about the positive change. I can take you back to East 100th Street, which Bruce Davidson photographed, who's alumni from here, and it was horrible back then. And now that block looks fantastic because the families came out, just like was being mentioned, after work at night, and demonstrated and demonstrated and demonstrated, and to to my some of my images we even used to send down to the mayor's office to show them what was happening with the housing crisis in Spanish Harlem. And so there are many blocks that were actually changed through the activism and the photographs that we took. So there has been change that I could visually see.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about this exhibit. It's Whose Streets, Our Streets, and the website, which you can follow along with as we talk about these images throughout these decades. WhoseStreets.photo is the website. Now, there is a panel discussion at the Carlson Auditorium at RIT this afternoon, 3:30 to 5 p.m., a great chance to hear from some of the people hearing on this program, really explore these topics in depth. 3:30 to 5 this afternoon at Carlson Auditorium. Opening reception from 5 to 7 tonight. Josh Meltzer, again, the opening reception tonight is where?
It'll be in Frank Gannett Hall and the William Harris Gallery, which is on the third floor. It's open to the public.
And the Harris Gallery is where you can see the exhibit on Mondays through Fridays from 9 to 4:30. And the weekends by appointment. If you want to check it out through, again, the show's running through
November 9th.
The exhibit's running through November 9th.
November 9th. And I should also say that we have a satellite exhibit at the Out Alliance
in Gallery Q. Gallery Q at the Out Alliance until when?
And that is up until October 25th.
Okay. And you've already had your opening there?
Yeah, last Friday.
Okay. So remarkable work from some very, very skilled and thoughtful photojournalists and documentary photographers. You just heard Josh Meltzer, Joseph Rodriguez, Meg Handler, all with us in studio for this discussion now. And I do want to ask them a little bit about the craft, if you don't mind. Because, you know, I'm thinking of a conversation we just had a couple weeks ago with Carlotta Walls, who was one of the Little Rock Nine in 1957 when desegregation was happening. Now, there are some obviously iconic photos that happened there. But you don't always have a moment like the first time that nine black students are going to go to a white high school in Arkansas. Sometimes things spring up pretty organically, or sometimes there's a lot of chaos, and it's up to the lens of a photographer and the thoughtful decision on and where to point it, how to capture it, and then how to faithfully represent it. Because I think some images are powerful and perfectly representative of very difficult moments, and then some might be sort of a little pulled out of context. And I want to ask all three, and I'll start with Joseph, for your thoughts on getting those images and understanding how to do that work.
Well, I mean, it's just about hanging out with the people and being with the activists week after week. There were many weeks prior to the images that are in the show that I made that it was just more about people organizing. You get to the street, you get to the lot, it's very disorganized. So to get back to your point, sometimes within this chaos, photographer has to kind of have this microscopic lens to see or to have this sort of intuition that maybe perhaps something's going to happen, right? So, you know, I would go week after week and to get to the images that I made. There was going to be this performance that no one knew was going to happen. So these little b-boy hip-hop kids get up on a stage with this big banner, right, Stop Gentrification in East Harlem, and all of a sudden these little kids who are so gifted at what they do, you know, got the audience standing up and being excited, and that became a photographic moment. So it wasn't something that I saw was going to happen. A lot of people were very sort of disorganized. Yeah, we're here to fight, but you know how these things can go. You have to sort of keep your eyes open as to what might be happening or what could happen and sort of try to put yourself in that situation.
Hmm. Meg?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that, you know, none of us know when we're making an iconic picture. It's very different back then than it is now. We didn't have the immediacy, number one. Number two, we were all working with film. The film had to be processed, contacted. Then you had to edit the picture and print the picture. And so it was a little bit like slow cooking, I'd say, where you kind of had to let the photograph get out there and marinate a little bit before it became iconic or it became recognizable. I'm not even talking about any pictures in particular. It's just the idea of the difference between shooting on film and shooting digitally. It was a different experience. And in terms of, you know, my intent and how I framed pictures, I always really wanted to see the humanity in people, first off, and then I also wanted to look at the theatricality of these demonstrations. There was a lot of street theater involved, and it wasn't just coming from the left. The right used theatrics too. You know, you the people from the pro-life movement holding up these really horrible posters that nobody really wanted to look at, and that was the point. And so how do you make a picture of those people holding those signs without focusing on the horror of the sign? And I think that that was my challenge as somebody who was documenting that movement. You know, how do I not show this as monstrous as it looks? And I found a way to do it, but it had to do with, like, what Joe said. You have to spend time with these groups. You have to kind of be a presence without the camera being up to your eye, so that you can be that fly on the wall.
Josh.
And I think the key word is always trust. You know, a subject that has trust in your intentions will let you see intimate moments, will let you participate with them on the streets. The other thing, just sort of, it's, you know, you guys touched on a little bit, is in the era of film, of course, there was also no social media. So how do you organize a march? You have phone trees, you have wheat pastings, you know, somebody calls 10 people and those 10 people call 10 people. And the photographers were part of that network. And so they would call each other, hey, there's going to be a rally here, or there's going to be a rally there, or so-and-so, or this is happening, or a political funeral. And we often forget about the actual organizing and how do you even know about what's going on. I mean, first it comes down to research and your connectivity to those communities. But on a day-to-day basis, where is the march and when is it happening? You know, you take Facebook out of the equation and Twitter and Instagram, and nobody would know how to communicate with each other today. And these guys had a system that worked very well at the time. We also, one of the things we did at the Bronx Documentary Center is we wheat pasted about half the exhibit on the streets. And we've mirrored that at RIT. There's a dozen or so pictures we pasted on the side of some of the brick buildings there to sort of reckon back to that time of communication on the streets, on the buildings themselves.
Sure.
Well, and I want to add about the wheat pasting and what we did in the Bronx. You know, we felt like we really wanted the show to be democratic. And, you know, not everybody's comfortable walking into a white cube kind of gallery. And weed pasting around the neighborhood was a great way to show the work to people who might have even been at those demonstrations, or their relatives were there. They have some connection to it, but they'd never walk in a gallery. And so that's, I think, and I think at RIT, you know, not every student might walk in a gallery. I mean, I'd like to think that they will, but it just gives another layer of the experience to people. Like I said, it democratizes it.
How many images are there at the gallery?
There's, I would say, close to 70 images, and then there's another 20-plus images at Gallery Q. So we're pretty close to about 100 images total. It's a very big show.
Whose Streets, Our Streets is what we're talking about. It's whostreets.photo. And if our guests don't mind, I'd like to ask them to maybe choose one to describe for our listeners. And to some degree, there's a risk. This is an audio medium. We can't see it. But I think from your perspective, I'd like to hear what stands out to you as a way for describing, because at the top of the hour, again, I mentioned an image with broken watermelons littering the streets in Bensonhurst after an anti-racism march, and just how ugly and devastating it is to see an image like that. I thought it was so powerful. There are so many different subjects that this exhibit touches on: race relations, police brutality, AIDS, queer activism, war, environmentalism, and a lot more. Joseph, is there one that comes to mind for you?
Well, for me, it was more about working with Deacon Lugo, who was a deacon on Saturday, Sunday, and I spent a lot of time with him because he was also an activist. He was a barber by day. So in his barbershop, he would just talk to the people that would come in, and I'd be sitting there and I'd listen, and he said, we're going to have a demonstration tonight. So, and then I didn't know what that demonstration was going to look like, but he was heading the demonstration with the crucifix, and on the crucifix, kind of nailed into the cross, were all the social issues that they were there to to demonstrate for. And I just always found that to be quite powerful because, you know, sometimes demonstrations can lean towards just one issue, but they were smart enough to put this all together because in Spanish Harlem, they've had this kind of religious activism for a long time. Every Good Friday, you can, anybody who wants to see this every year, it can go up there. Every Good Friday, they have this huge procession throughout the streets of Spanish Harlem where they go to all the different churches, but they don't just stop to pray. They stop to talk about the issues that are troubling and the challenges that they face in their community. I thought that was quite remarkable.
Hmm. Meg.
Oh, you're putting me in a bad position. Well, one of as the curator of the show, it's hard to, you know, pick out one photo, but I think one of the pictures that I think is really powerful is Tom McGovern's photograph of a gentleman carrying the coffin of activist John Greenberg. One of the things that was who died of AIDS. One of the things that started happening in the streets of New York were these things called political funerals, and they were done by the request of the deceased. So John Greenberg wanted his body carried through the streets of the East Village to make a point about, you know, AIDS education, funding, you know, all of the issues that were surrounding HIV and AIDS and at the time, and that ACT UP was working so hard to get funding, to get people to understand what this disease was. And if you think about it today, the idea of walking a coffin up First Avenue is, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if that's something that people can conceive of, but it was a very powerful statement to make. And Tom, who was a photographer and also a photo editor at The Village Voice, did a lot of documentation of people with AIDS and of ACT UP. And I think that is an iconic picture. It's on the cover of our catalog. It's a beautiful photograph. And I think there's a lot to be learned from it.
Josh.
I'd point to one of Meg's pictures. Meg decided to photograph a group of activists who she didn't sort of agree with. And I think that speaks volumes to the dedication that the photographers have to really show empathy to others. So, you know, she looked at the pro-life activists to try to understand them, you know, to say they're just as passionate as I am out on the streets. I don't understand their point of view. I'm going to spend time with them and hang out with them. And so she did that. And I think that it also points to the fact that the show is not all about activism from the left and the empathy that photographers have towards the people that they spend a tremendous amount of time with. I think especially in an era where we hear this term fake news, to think that photographers who are on the ground with real people every day photographing them, I think really counters that, and the show speaks to that quite a lot.
What a powerful point. So as we get to ready to close this portion of our conversation for the hour, Meg, she's saying thank you right across the table. Well done, Josh. And, you know, Meg, in that moment, you have said that it's easy to think of someone with this kind of viewpoint as, considering your own views on this, as monstrous. And it's easy for us to think about anybody who have ideological differences as monstrous. How, as a photographer, do you approach making sure your bias is not going to sort of get into that lens?
Okay, well, let me clarify that because that's a big statement. I was describing the posters that
absolutely,
but
we
as
are,
monsters.
We are certainly
not the
though
people.
At this, but we're at the point now where you know. So we had a state assemblyman die by suicide a couple years ago, rather than face up to corruption,
mm-hmm.
just before an election.
Mm-hmm.
Voters are so tribal and so beholden to party that they would rather vote for the dead, recently deceased, obviously corrupt person as opposed to vote for the person from the other party. And that person wins the election,
mm-hmm.
posthumously. So we are looking at each other as sort of monstrous. whether we understand that or not, I think that's dangerous.
I don't disagree with you, and I think that one of the great challenges in being at the kind of documentary photographer I am and Joseph is and many of our peers is to not look at people in that way. And it doesn't mean don't look at them critically, but it means, as Josh said, look at them with empathy. Try and understand you can't stand in their shoes, but you can try and understand where they're coming from. And if somebody is a fundamentalist and believes very specific things, then I, as a documentarian, have to respect that and understand it. Doesn't mean I agree with it. Now, I navigated those waters by literally making eye contact with people and listening to them. I didn't argue with anybody. I didn't get into, you know, political conversations with people. I kept it very neutral, which is, you know, maybe particularly manipulative or whatever, but that was kind of my way of having an exchange. But again, you can look into somebody's eyes and let them know you understand them, and all of their defense mechanisms are going to come down, and they're going to, I don't know. It's kind of this exchange that happens between photographer and subject, and it's a shared moment. But those things don't just happen. You both have to give something. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It's profound in this day and age now. Joseph, I know you want to jump in before
I just
go.
I just want to just make it real short.
Yeah.
We call it the humanist gaze. That's what it is. That's the viewpoint that I stand behind. And Meg stands behind. We're looking at social realism. We're looking at reality in front of us, which Marilyn Mark used to say always was the best kind of photography there is out there, is to look at who we are. And that's what the camera's invented for. So I think that if we can get to the humanity of these folks, just the way Meg was handling these, you know, and some people would call them adversaries, you know. I just saw a film called Jackson, which is very much profiled around Roe versus Wade, and you see those people there along with the other people that we're fighting for. But in I think what the documentarian tries to do is to just try to humanize both sides. And I think that that's where we can begin, hopefully, more of coming together and having conversations.
All right, Whose Streets, Our Streets. It's whosestreets.photo, and see it in the gallery. The opening tonight, there's an opening reception this evening from 5 to 7 p.m., and you can attend if you like. It's at the RIT's Harris Gallery, where you can see Whose Streets through November
9th.
November 9th is when you can see at the Harris Gallery. They also are showing at Gallery Q, about 20 images or so as well, at Gallery Q, which has already opened up as well here. I want to thank our guests for being here and sharing their expertise and the extraordinary images. Josh Meltzer, thanks for reaching out, and continued success. Really appreciate your time here. Thank you.
Thanks for having us, Evan.
He's a photojournalist and assistant professor at RIT. Meg Handler, documentary photographer, RIT alumna. Thank you, Meg. I really appreciate
that. Thank you for having us.
You got it. And Joseph Rodriguez, documentary photographer and professor at NYU.
Thank you,
Joseph.
Thank you for having us.
Short break, and we continue on the subject of photojournalism with one of their colleagues and a Pulitzer winner himself four times over in just a moment. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections, it's another opportunity for voters to hear a debate on Connections. We invite office holders and challengers in upcoming elections to join us on Connections together. Joe Errigo is the incumbent for his assembly seat. He was defeated in a primary by Marjorie Burns. She will join us alongside the Democrat challenging her, Barbara Baer. Join us Friday on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. You just heard documentary photographers, and now I want to bring in the director of the photojournalism program at RIT and a four-time Pulitzer winner himself who has done work in photojournalism across the country and now here in Rochester, William Snyder. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
I know you had a chance to listen to that conversation. You know some of these folks pretty well. And so before we jump in with a slight diversion here, I want to ask you for your thoughts on the power of these kind of images that represent social movements. Again, sometimes where change is happening very, very slowly, sometimes what feels like not at all, but sometimes these images seem to really move the public needle in profound ways.
Well, I think, you know, people respond to images of real people doing real things. And unfortunately, for example, that image that you've referenced a couple of times, I mean, what a horrible, horrible idea. What a horrible, horrible image. And it moves people. Now, hopefully it moves them in the right direction and that there aren't people that look at that and go, hey, yeah, that's a great idea. But, you know, that's why we do this work. That's why we do this work. We're trying to tell stories. We're trying to get the word out, whatever it may be. We're trying to communicate with the rest of the world, which is, again, you and I had an earlier conversation about this. It gets back to the idea of what these protests do and what their potential is, and is referenced in Josh's documentary, and you talked about it. The well-focused, the well-intentioned, the relentlessness of certain protests do bear results. The ACT UP protest, I mean, it got a lot of things changed and a lot of things done. The women's movement, while still going on, things have changed. And so I think it's important to remember that. And for me, it's like telling a story. If you've got a story and you don't have a focus and you don't have a theme, it's hard to get your word across. And that's what the best protests do, and that's one reason why they work, and it also makes it easier to photograph.
Well, we've talked about some heavy things today on Connections, and I'd like to spend our last 10 minutes or so trying to have a little bit of fun talking photojournalism, because William Snyder has not only documented some of the heaviest subjects and most difficult moments in our country's history, but also you got a side passion for music and The Who, and you have a new book out. It's called Join Together, and I'm holding it right now. I actually had to lift weights to hold this.
There we go.
It's a big book. Tell me about the book.
Well, it's culmination of really 20 hard years, but 30 years of love for this band and photographing this band. You know, Pete Townsend, the guitarist and major songwriter for the band, I mean, one of the first songs that ever meant anything to me was his, I guess what you would call a protest song, Won't Get Fooled Again. It is about, in many ways, about the same things that we're talking, you know, we're previously talking about. You know, trying to make a shift from a very, very serious subject to something that's not quite so serious.
No, but it's true, though.
It's true. And that's the thing is that, you know, my love of this band comes for a variety of reasons because it's a very visceral band. It's a very intellectual band, even though it is about emotion. And I think what I've tried to do in these pictures is to capture a lot of that. I'm not interested in your typical rock and roll pictures, although The Who are nothing but masters of the rock and roll pose.
Boy, are they ever.
Oh, yes.
And if you're not interested in those poses, you have plenty in here, and you have the best of those poses. You have amazing moments.
Well,
here.
I appreciate that. And that's one of the things, I mean, we consciously went through. I mean, the band has been incredibly generous to me over the last 20 years, 20 plus years, and allowed me access. And what I've tried to do is show people sort of who they are off stage. And, you know, from Roger Daltrey's goofiness to Pete Townsend's, you know, he really can be a warm and sweet guy. And like everybody else, even though he's known for smashing guitars and yelling at people from the stage, I've tried to give you a sense of what it's like to be in that family. And in a way, that's what this book is about. It's about my journey from sitting up in the rafters in my very first concert in 1976. That'll give you an idea how old I am. And watching this band and slowly but surely working my way, you know, up to the front of the stage and finally back there and becoming part of this inner family. You know, there was a time where I was had a fairly good relationship with Pete, and then that sort of just went away. We still corresponded from time to time. But in doing this book, what I realized is I've actually spent a lot of time with Roger Daltrey, and he's a really great guy, good sense of humor, very smart, regardless of the fact that, you know, everybody thinks of him as this, you know, sheet metal worker from East London. So it's been a lot of fun getting to know these guys and to photograph them, and now to share that with everybody.
The book is Joined Together. It's all about The Who and Photojournalism from William's Perspective here. Great stories in the book. And you are doing something that's pretty cool here. Half of all the profits from the book are going to benefit Teen Cancer America. Why did you choose that?
Well, Teen Cancer America is Pete and Roger's large charity here in the United States. Roger sort of came up with this idea 20-plus years ago. Somewhere along the line, he became aware of the fact that if you're a teenager and you have cancer, you either go into the pediatrics ward or you go in with the adults. And neither one of those places is really appropriate or good for teenagers. So what they did was they originally started Teen Cancer Trust in Great Britain to build teen cancer wards across the islands. Well, they succeeded. They built out Great Britain. And so they were asked to bring this to the United States, and they did. I'm not quite exactly sure when, but they now have Teen Cancer America. And this is my way, giving them 50% of the profits. And my wife really wasn't happy about that, but it's a really good cause. And it's my way also to thank them for being so kind and so generous and so giving over the years and allowing me to do this.
I'm thinking of the Who fans in my life, and I used to work with a video journalist at Channel 13 who's the biggest Who fan I know. So Terry Hancock, if you're listening, don't buy William's book. I'm going to buy it for you.
Oh, well, there you go.
You're much deserving. And William is, in fact, going to be at Barnes & Noble Pittsford, which is, by the way, you are a much better marketer than I realized. You're doing this right in time for Christmas, aren't you?
Oh, but of course I am. I'm going to be at the Barnes & Noble in Pittsford on December 1st from 1 to 3 o'clock. So please come on out. But in the meantime, you know, I'll be there. I'll tell you some stories. I'll sign some books. Hopefully you'll buy some books. You can buy the book there. You can also buy it from our website. The name of the book is Joined Together with the Band. And so we rather pithily came up with Joined Together with the Book. So what it is www.joinedtogetherwiththebook.com. And you can go there, and we have a limited number of already signed books. Now, some of you will say, well, I'll just buy one and have you sign it. Remember, 50% of our profits go to teen cancer. So it's a good cause. It'll make you feel good. And here's the thing. There are a lot of you out there that probably aren't Who fans, but you know somebody who is, and Christmas is coming up. Christmas is coming up. It's a great book.
Beating a drum. I'm beating a drum for teen cancer.
Yes.
Before we go here, a couple of things. What is, for someone who's publishing a book, you've been in journalism your whole life, but now you got to think about this. What's the best place to actually buy a book like this for the author and for the cause here?
Well, for the author and for the cause is our website. You can buy it in all the usual places, but for the cause, the best thing to do is to go to our website. Again, www.joinedtogetherwiththebook.com. There's no discounts there, and we don't have to share it with any of the other companies. It's all us.
I just got a text from my friend Doug who says, I too will take one of those books, thanks. Doug, it's expensive. I've got one for Terry, and you're going to have to get your own.
Oh, come on. $60 for a Christmas gift is not expensive. Come on.
Hey, 2 minutes left, so let's tell a story here. Right off the top of the book, there are some gorgeous photographs of a guy who I did not know was going to be in this book, and that's Eddie Vedder, who wrote a foreword for you. What's Eddie's connection to The Who?
Well, Eddie, and the reason that he wrote this is that he is a huge, huge Who fan. And so, like myself, he started out by seeing them as a kid and just falling in love with them. And now, as many of you may or may not know, Ed performs with them a lot and does a lot of work with them. And I was fortunate enough to meet him through The Who, and I asked him if he'd be part of this, and I thought, well, you know, 50-50. He came back immediately and said, of course, I understand. What do you want me to do? And he wrote this beautiful foreword. And it's for me, it's one of the highlights of the book. I'm proud of my pictures, but I love this foreword.
Your pictures are great. He's really aging beautifully. He's a good-looking guy. Your pictures make him really look like a good-looking guy. Some great shots with the band. I did not know that he performs with them.
Yes, he's performed with them multiple times. Hmm. Usually it's for charity.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the other reason that he agreed to do this, because a lot of the times that he performs with them is for Teen Cancer America. He's done a couple of other things, but you know, he's a big fan. He really is a big fan, and you can tell that he loves being there with them.
All right, down to our last minute or so. Are you going out on the road anytime soon?
With them? Depends on what they do. Roger will continue to go out as long as he can. His voice is sounding amazing. For those of you that were there earlier this year that saw him do Tommy with an orchestra and the band, you know what I mean. And for those of you that didn't, you missed a really great show. There's a rumor that they're going to go out this summer, but who knows? There's lots of rumors around the Who. Who knows?
All right, and the last question for you then. 20 seconds. The best place to see the Who that you've ever seen is where?
Oh, the best place to see the Who. I think the best place to see the Who is probably either Chicago or Philadelphia or New York, because the fans are huge in those places. So the Garden is great. Any venue in Philadelphia, any venue in Chicago.
Senator Snyder, you did not answer the question. I'm going to direct you one time. Choose one venue.
One venue. Oh. I guess it's the Garden.
All right. Pictures in the Garden in this book?
Oh, yeah. All over the
all
place.
All kinds of pictures.
Yeah.
Join together with the band. It's joinedtogetherwiththebook.com.
WWW is really important for some reason.
Okay. And you can see him on December 1st at the Pittsford Barnes & Noble. They're benefiting Teen Cancer and Teen Cancer America, which is great stuff. William Snyder, four-time Pulitzer winner and director of the photojournalism program at RIT. Fascinating stuff from all of your crew at RIT. Thanks for being here this hour.
Thank you for having all of us.
All right, our thanks to Rob Braden, engineer. Tiana Magnon working with us today. Great to have Tiana here. Megan Mack is the producer of Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Talk to you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.